Major new updates from Proton. Dating app privacy is worse than ever. A case of deepfakes in a school setting. Uh-oh. And some unsettling research into phone keyboards, which is not good for your Android users. Welcome to Surveillance Report 175, where we are dedicated to keeping you private and secure with the latest news in the past week. I'm Henry from TechLore.
I'm Nathan from The New Oil.
As always, we have our normal promo segment, which at the moment is Patreon. If you want to support our work, if you like what we do, if you like this news and you like staying up to date with what we talk about, Patreon is the best way to contribute to what we do. And you can do that down below at patreon.com/surveillancepod. You also get access to longer episodes where we have more analysis and more back and forth and sometimes some little debates on some of the stories. And also, if you don't like Patreon, we're also on LiberPay and we're also on Monero. And all those things can be found in a description. We appreciate all the support you can give us. And without further ado, let's talk about the highlight story and get into the stories.
Okay, our highlight story this week is a collection of stories, actually. There are updates coming from Proton. First up, we have dark web monitoring for credential leaks. This applies to everyone with a paid Proton plan. You can find it in the new security center in Proton Mail and in your security and privacy settings. Dark web monitoring scans hidden parts of the internet for Proton Mail email addresses that have ended up in illegal data markets. If our system detects a breach that affected one of your accounts used to sign up to a third-party website, you'll receive a security center alert along with actions you can take to mitigate the risk. The next update is that Proton Pass is now available on F-Droid. They said the F-Droid distribution was a popular request among many members of the community, and we are excited to announce that Android users can now secure their passwords and digital identity without having to hand over any personal data if they don't want to. Proton Pass will continue to be available on the Play Store, as this is where most Android users prefer to get their apps. You can also download any Proton app from our Proton Apps page if you don't want to use a third-party app store. Above all, we want to make sure that everyone has the freedom to make their own choices rather than be locked into the decisions of a small number of dominant tech companies.
Two more updates that we're going to talk about here. The first one is Proton Calendar, specifically for businesses. So if you have a business account, you can now see the availability of colleagues and avoid meeting conflicts in that shared calendar that they've released in the past. So that's a cool thing for businesses, but not really for anyone that's not a business. And then Proton Calendar for iOS now has a week view. I've personally seen a lot of people complain about that. So everyone who wanted that, there you go. What do you think of these updates?
I think I just enabled dark web monitoring on my personal account while you were talking, and it says no account information was found in any data breaches, and I find that sus.
Okay.
No, I'm indifferent to dark web monitoring. We've talked about it in a Q&A before, and my criticism is, again, unless I'm misunderstanding how it works, they can really only monitor known websites, which, I mean, is better than nothing, but I feel like it's a little bit oversold and it's kind of a reactive tool. A useful tool, but kind of reactive. So it's nice to see, but I think it's kind of just, I think it's more of an emotional thing. If you want to know what's out there, or how much is out there, or if a new breach has popped up, I guess it's good for that. But that's about it. As far as Proton Pass, I'm in favor of this. I mean, if you don't want to use F-Droid, you don't have to. Like they said, you can still download it directly, but I think that's cool that they're trying to expand into F-Droid. For Proton Calendar, I think it's cool for businesses. Again, it's for businesses. I don't use Proton for business, but I do like the idea of being able to see other people's availability if you're in the same business. And I really have no opinion on the weekly view because I don't use weekly view on any of my calendars. I'm a monthly kind of person, either monthly or task, like what's next on the calendar. But again, it's nice for people to have options. So overall, I think this is good stuff, but nothing really earth shattering, I guess.
Yeah, I really like Proton Pass being in F-Droid. So that, as far as I know, in my head makes Proton VPN and Proton Pass on F-Droid, but we're still missing Proton Calendar, Proton Drive, and Proton Mail. To my knowledge, those don't exist on F-Droid, but Proton Mail you can get through Izzy's repo.
Oh, maybe that's what I'm thinking of. I was going to say, I thought Proton Mail was.
Mm-mm. I think it exists on Izzy's repo, but not on formal F-Droid.
Yeah, you're right. Proton Pass, Proton VPN, and something that says you have mail email notification without Google Play services.
Yeah, it'd be cool to see their other stuff there, but I think it's, in my opinion, it's pretty representative of how Proton runs things, which it seems like it's just individual teams doing their own thing with little integration between them. So I'm not surprised that 2 out of 5 Proton apps are actually on F-Droid. But I didn't actually know. That's really cool. They allow you to download all of them, apparently, on their site. I didn't know that, so I'm guessing you can just download an APK directly from the site, which is pretty cool.
My question with that, and you may know this, how good is the support for self-updating APKs? Like, do most APKs update automatically, or is that like hit or miss, or most don't?
They have to build the integration into the APK itself. So what Signal does is really unique. Like Signal, if you get the APK from its website on Android, it'll update itself just like every other Signal that auto-updates. But that's actually a different APK, and it has that feature built in because it assumes you don't have an app store. I don't know what Proton does, but I haven't heard that Proton does that. So either I haven't heard that and they do it, or they just don't do that and you still have to manually update the APK every time.
I was just curious because I've seen some apps that advertise like, oh, the APK auto updates, but I've seen some don't advertise it. And so I'm like, well, is that a rare feature or is that just like really common and they're just kind of like, you know, looking for things to list as a bonus.
Now we're going to talk about data breaches, and we're going to start with India's ICICI bank exposed thousands of credit cards to wrong users. This bank has 6,000 branches in India and it's in 17 countries worldwide, and the iMobile Pay app has over 28 million users. Their digital channels erroneously mapped about 17,000 credit cards issued in the past few days to wrong users. The issue came to light after some customers raised concern on social media about the bank's iMobile Pay app exposing unknown people's credit card details, including their full number and card verification value. The spokesperson added that the number of impacted credit cards constituted about 0.1% of the bank's credit card portfolio. Sensitive data, such as the full card number, expiry date, and CVV of unknown customers' credit cards, suddenly appeared for some users on this app. The bank spokesperson told TechCrunch it blocked the affected cards and is issuing new cards to customers. We don't really know probably how many people were impacted by this and who was impacted by this and who might have seen someone else's information, but something to be aware of, especially if you use this bank.
Health insurance giant Kaiser will notify millions of data breach after sharing patients' data with advertisers. This is the whole Metapixel, Google Analytics, that kind of thing. Kaiser said that they conducted an investigation and found, quote, certain online technologies previously installed on its websites and mobile applications may have transmitted personal information to third-party vendors, unquote. Kaiser said that the data shared with advertisers included member names and IP addresses, as well as information that could indicate if members were signed into a Kaiser Permanente account or service, and how members, quote, interacted with and navigated through the website and mobile applications and search terms used in the health encyclopedia. Kaiser said it subsequently removed the tracking code from its websites and mobile apps. The organization will be notifying about 13.4 million affected current and former members and patients.
Los Angeles County Health Services patients' data exposed in phishing attack. The Integrated Health Systems operates the public hospitals and clinics in LA, which is the most populous county in the U.S. and the second largest public healthcare system in the country after New York City Health and Hospitals. 23 employees had their mailboxes compromised after their credentials were stolen in a February attack, which impacts about 6,000 individuals. This includes first and last names, date of births, home addresses, phone numbers, email addresses, medical record numbers, client identification numbers, date of service, medical information like diagnosis, conditions, treatments, test results, and medications, and or health plan information.
LivaNova gives notice of personal patient data compromised by cybercriminals. This included name, contact information, social security number, date of birth, medical information, treatment, condition, diagnosis, prescription, physician, medical record number, and device serial number, and health insurance information. The article did not specify how many people, and of course, identity theft protection services are being made available to the victims.
And there's one more, because Change Healthcare finally admits it paid ransomware hackers and still faces a patient data leak. More than 2 months after the start of a ransomware debacle whose impact ranks among the worst in the history of cybersecurity, the medical firm Change Healthcare finally confirmed what cybercriminals, security researchers, and Bitcoin's blockchain had already made very clear, that it did indeed pay a ransom to the hackers who targeted the company in February. A ransom was paid as part of the company's commitment to do all it could to protect patient data from disclosure. As of Monday, the listing for that data, and the second group claims to have, which we covered last week, had been taken down. Change Healthcare's post to its website, however, warns that 22 screenshots of its data had been posted to the dark web by an unnamed hacker group and that they included protected health information or personally identifiable information, though it said it hadn't seen any sign that medical records like doctors' charts or full medical histories for any patients were among the stolen data. A survey of American Medical Association members conducted between March 26th and April 3rd found that 4 out of 5 clinicians had lost revenue as a result of the crisis. Many said they were using their own personal finances to cover a practice's expenses. Change Healthcare, meanwhile, says it has lost $872 million to the incident and projects that number to rise well over $1 billion in the longer term.
We'll move into companies. We'll start off with WhatsApp, who has added global support for passkeys on iOS. This will remove the need for users to deal with SMS one-time passcodes. The iOS launch comes 6 months after WhatsApp introduced passkey support on Android. The company announced that the feature is rolling out now and will be available to all iOS users in the coming weeks. Once enabled, iOS users can log back into WhatsApp using passkey verification via facial recognition, biometrics, or a PIN stored on Apple's passkey manager.
Google can't quit third-party cookies and delays shutdown for a third time. Google says it won't turn off third-party cookies until 2025, and this is part of a new blog post that cites UK regulations as the reason for the delay, saying, "We recognize that there are ongoing challenges related to reconciling divergent feedback from the industry, regulators, and developers, and will continue to engage closely with the entire ecosystem." The post comes as part of quarterly reports the company is producing with the UK's Competition and Markets Authority, or the CMA.
Photo sharing community IAM will license users' photos to train AI if they don't delete them. So IAM is a Berlin-based photo sharing community that exited last year to Spanish company Freepik after going bankrupt. Earlier this month, the company informed users via email that it was adding a new clause to its terms and conditions that would grant it the right to upload users' content to, quote, train, develop, and improve software, algorithms, and machine learning models, unquote. Users were given 30 days to opt out by removing all their content from IAM's platform. Otherwise, they were consenting to this use case for their work. At the time of its 2023 acquisition, IAM's photo library included 160 million images and nearly 150,000 users. Section 13 of the updated terms of service detailed a complicated process for deletions that begins with first deleting photos directly, which, should be noted, would not impact content that had previously been shared to IAM Magazine or social media, according to the company. To delete content from the IAM Market, where photographers sold their photos, or other platforms, users would have to submit a request to support@iam.com and provide the content ID numbers for those photos they wanted to delete and whether it should be removed from their account as well or only the market. It should also be noted, the notice says that these deletions from the market and partner platforms could take up to 180 days. Quoting the article here, yes, that's right. Requested deletions take up to 6 months, but users only have 30 days to opt out. That means the only option is manually deleting photos one by one. Worse still, the company adds that, quote, "You hereby acknowledge and agree that your authorization for IAM to market and license your content according to Sections 8 and 10 will remain valid until the content is deleted from IAM and all partner platforms within the timeframe indicated above. All license agreements entered into before complete deletion and the rights of use granted thereby remain unaffected by the request for deletion or the deletion." Section 8 is where licensing rights to train AI are detailed. In Section 10, IAM informs users that they will forgo their rights to any payout for their work if they delete their account. I actually really appreciated this last quote here. "This sort of dishonest behavior is why users today are considering a move to the open social web. The federated platform PixelFed, which runs on the same ActivityPub protocol that powers Mastodon, is capitalizing on the IAM situation to attract users. In a post on its official account, PixelFed announced, quote, 'We will never use your images to help train AI models. Privacy first, pixels forever,' unquote."
Ex-NSA hacker and ex-Apple researcher have launched a startup to protect Apple devices. And the startup is called Double U, like you are all awesome for watching surveillance report, that you. Double U. And the name is taken from the initials of its co-founder, which is Patrick Wardle. He worked at the U.S. National Security Agency between 2006 and 2008. Then he worked as an offensive security researcher for years before switching to an independently researching Apple macOS defensive security. Since 2015, he's developed free and open source macOS security tools under the umbrella of his Objective-C Foundation. The idea behind Double U, which is this new thing, is that compared to Windows, there are still only a few good security products for macOS and iPhones. And that's that's a problem because Macs are becoming a more popular choice for companies all over the world, meaning malicious hackers are also increasingly targeting Apple computers. They said there are not as many talented macOS and iOS security researchers, which means companies are struggling to develop their own products. So the idea is to take a page out of the playbook of hackers that specialize in attacking systems and applying it to defense. Several offensive cybersecurity companies offer modular products capable of delivering a full chain of exploits or just one component of it. And the W team wants to do just that, but on the defensive. So they haven't decided on the full list of modules they're going to offer. They said the product will certainly include a core offering, which includes analyzing all new processes to detect and block untrusted code, which in macOS world means they're not notarized by Apple, and monitoring for any blocking anomalous DNS traffic, which can uncover malware when it connects to domains known to be associated to hacking groups. Wordle said that these, at least for now, will be primarily for macOS, and the founders want to develop tools to monitor software that wants to become persistent, a hallmark of malware to detect cryptocurrency miners and ransomware based on their behavior, and to detect when software tries to get permission to use the webcam and mic. They described it as an off-the-shelf catalog approach where every customer can pick and choose which components they need to implement in their product. And the plan for now is to not take any outside investment. The co-founders said they want to remain independent and avoid some of the pitfalls of getting outside investment, namely the need to scale too much and too fast, which will allow them to focus on developing their technology.
And our last company story is an update. Discord shuts down spy pet bots that scraped and sold user messages. We covered this last week. Basically, there was this, I guess, company. It sounds like there's an individual behind it, but it was a website where you could go and you could pay to look up certain users or certain servers and you could see all their messages because basically they just made a bunch of bots, joined as many servers as they could, and basically had information on pretty much every Discord user. This comes from 404 Media. Discord banned a mass of accounts that were part of a service that scraped and sold user data, including messages posted across servers and what voice channels they joined. The move comes after 404 Media reported on the service, called SpyPet, last week and verified it was selling access to genuine user messages ripped from Discord servers. Since then, and especially over the last several days, the number of servers that SpyPet says it collects data from has fluctuated, dropping from around 14,000 to 12,000 before eventually on Thursday reaching zero. As of Friday, the SpyPet website is also unavailable, and Discord says it is considering legal action against the site. On their Telegram channel, the administrator said that their domain had been suspended, but that they had planned to set up a backup domain. The admin also told 404 Media that the domain suspension was unconnected to Discord actions, that the server counter on the site went to zero because they had to rewrite part of SpyPet, and added that Discord did ban a number of their bots. But they also claimed that they haven't heard from Discord about any kind of legal action.
And now we're going to dive into the research of the week, and we're going to start with data-hungry dating apps are worse than ever for your privacy as the headline. When we reviewed dating apps for the first time back in 2021, they did not do well against our privacy and security criteria. This time, our research shows they've gotten even worse for your privacy, and in 2024, the stakes are even higher. The nature of dating apps means they probably need to collect some sensitive and personal information from you, which is fine, but they learned that companies often take advantage of that and use your personal information for reasons totally unrelated to love. They often say they can share it, sell it, or just don't do the bare minimum to keep that data secure. 22 out of the 25, which is 88% of the dating apps they reviewed, came with privacy not included. In their privacy policies, often the companies say that providing all this information is optional, and sometimes that's true, but often misleading. Like when Tinder says they only collect your precise geolocation with your consent, but also the app won't work without it. So the old, if you don't like it, you can leave kind of consent model. On top of that, there is more data that you almost definitely don't know about, like information that's collected from third parties, your device, or taken from your photos. About 25% of the apps collect metadata from your content. Others say they can scan your content for information using third-party services to help identify your interests and activities, like if your photo includes pets, sports, or trips to help them provide better matches for you, which seems very unnecessary, especially when users are already asked about those things for their profiles. It's also not surprising that the same number of apps, 52%, earned their bad track record ding for a data breach, leak, or hack in the past 3 years. And those breaches have been really bad. The top three privacy tips that are offered are 1. Treat your dating profile more like your LinkedIn profile. Assume it could be seen by anyone and only post photos and details you're okay with being public. That's good advice for pretty much anything on the internet, actually. Two, don't log in with third-party accounts and don't link your social media accounts to your profile. That invites even more sharing of your personal information across more places that don't always do a good job with it. This also aligns with things we talk about here, which is just try to not link things up too much when you can. And three, limit app permissions where possible from your device settings like your location, address book, and camera roll. The less you share, the better. So just permission access is really solid. And I'll go a step further and include things like you can probably try to keep some of these apps in your browser. I know Tinder and Bumble have web apps, so you can keep that directly in your web app without even needing the app in the first place. Inside of that, you can probably have things like ad blockers and tracking protection as well, which should help you out a little bit more. DNS block lists might be able to help too, depending on how they're collecting some of this data, and also alias information as well, like emails and phone numbers to help protect that information. And also, I guess, more practical advice too, that these are all my tips, so if I get anything wrong, feel free to correct me. But also, some of these apps have things like travel mode, which allow you to set your location in nearby areas so that people don't actually see your actual location, if that makes sense. So I know that Bumble offers a travel mode, so you can set your location to be somewhere 20 minutes away and you keep it there, which I think is especially important because if you're dating and you match with somebody, they can actually see where you go because it constantly broadcasts your location. So someone can see if you leave town, someone can see if you're going somewhere else. But if you set it to travel mode, it's going to be the same location 24/7.
I think in some of those apps, things like travel mode are premium features you have to pay for.
Yes, they are.
Okay. Almost every Chinese keyboard app has a security flaw that reveals what users type. If this sounds familiar, it is, but it's worse than last time. The vulnerability, which allows the keystroke data that these apps send to the cloud to be intercepted, has existed for years and could have been exploited by cybercriminals and state surveillance groups, according to researchers at Citizen Lab. So they're talking about the actual software keyboard that usually the ones that come stock with phones, but there are a lot that you can go download as well. They're popular with Chinese people because they help users type Chinese characters more efficiently and are ubiquitous on devices used by Chinese people. The four most popular apps built by major companies like Baidu, Tencent, and iFlyTech basically account for all the typing methods that Chinese people use. Researchers also looked into the keyboard apps that come pre-installed on Android phones sold in China. Almost every third-party app and every Android phone with pre-installed keyboards failed to protect users by properly encrypting the content they typed. A smartphone made by Huawei was the only device where no such security vulnerability was found. In August 2023, the same researchers found that Sogou, one of the most popular keyboard apps, did not use Transport Layer Security, or TLS, when submitting keystroke data to its cloud server for better typing predictions. Even though Sogou fixed this issue after it was made public last year, some Sogou keyboards pre-installed on phones are not updated to the latest version, so they are still subject to eavesdropping. This new finding shows that the vulnerability is far more widespread than previously believed. The massive scale of the problem is compounded by the fact that these vulnerabilities aren't hard to exploit. And quoting one of the researchers, you don't need huge supercomputers crunching numbers. You don't need to collect terabytes of data. If you're just a person who wants to target another person on your Wi-Fi, you could do that once you understand the vulnerability. After the researchers got in contact with companies that developed these keyboard apps, the majority of the loopholes were fixed, and the article particularly noted Samsung. They said, but a few companies have been unresponsive, and the vulnerability still exists in some apps and phones, including, sorry, it has a little red squiggly there, I think that's QO Pinyin and Baidu, as well as in any keyboard app that hasn't been updated to the latest version. And enjoy laughing at my god-awful pronunciations. I know that none of those were right.
U.S. government says security flaw in Chirp Systems app lets anyone remotely control smart home locks. This went public with a security advisory last week saying that the phone apps developed by Chirp, which people use in place of a key to access their homes, improperly stores hard-coded credentials that can be used to remotely control any compatible smart lock. The cybersecurity agency gave the vulnerability security score of 9.1 out of a maximum 10 for its low attack complexity and for its ability to be remotely exploited. The cybersecurity agency said Chirp Systems has not responded to either CISA or the researcher who found a vulnerability. Chirp Systems is one of a growing number of companies in the property tech space that provide keyless access controls that integrate with smart home technologies to rental giants. Rental companies are increasingly forcing renters to allow the installation of these as dictated by their leases, but it's murky at best who takes responsibility or ownership when security problems arise.
Could ChatGPT be the next big cybersecurity worry? quoting this article, previously believed to only be able to exploit simpler cybersecurity vulnerabilities, large language models, or LLMs, have shown a surprisingly high proficiency in exploiting complex ones as well. Researchers at the University of Illinois Urbana-Champaign found that GPT-4 demonstrates a scarily high proficiency in exploiting one-day vulnerabilities in real-world systems. One day being, we know about it, but we haven't patched it, I'm assuming from context. In a dataset of 15 such vulnerabilities, GPT-4 was capable of exploiting an alarming 87% of them. This is a striking contrast to other language models like GPT-3.5, OpenHermes 2.5, Mistral 7b, and Llama 2 Chat 70b, as well as vulnerability scanners like Zap and Metasploit, all of which recorded a 0% success rate. The caveat, however, is that for such high performance, GPT-4 requires the vulnerability description from the CVE database. Without the CVE description, GPT-4's success rate falls drastically to just 7%.
Ransomware payments dropped to record low of 28% in quarter one of 2024. For quarter one of 2024, it shows companies are increasingly refusing to pay extortion demands, leading to a record low of 28% of companies paying ransomware in the first quarter of 2024. This figure was 29% of quarter four of 2023, and the stats show that diminishing payments have remained steady since early 2019. The decrease is due to organizations implementing more advanced protective measures, mounting legal pressure not to meet the financial demands, and cyber criminals repeatedly breaching promises not to publish or resell stolen data if a ransomware is paid. However, it's essential to note that despite the drop in the payment rate, the amount paid to actors is higher than ever before, reaching $1.1 billion last year. This is due to ransomware gangs hitting more organizations by escalating their attack frequency and demanding more substantial figures for not exposing stolen secrets and providing victims with a decryption key.
With that, we'll move into politics. This one's pretty quick, and we're more just covering it because it's been such a big deal. Biden has officially signed the bill that would ban TikTok if ByteDance doesn't sell the app. Some of you, I think at least one person did post in the comments when we posted the podcast last week. Like Monday morning, there was a comment that was like, yeah, they signed it Sunday night or like Sunday morning. It's like basically between the time we recorded and the time we released it. So just quick friendly reminder on that note, it takes us a couple days to edit this and get it out. We usually record Fridays. We publish Sundays. If a story happens over the weekend, it's probably not going to be in here. Just go ahead and email it to us and we'll cover it next time. The bill included aid for Ukraine and Israel. The bill gives ByteDance 9 months to divest TikTok with a 90-day extension available to complete a deal. If ByteDance doesn't sell, it would become illegal for app stores to distribute the app in the U.S. In an emailed statement to TechCrunch, TikTok said it would challenge the quote-unquote unconstitutional law in court.
Kind of unrelated to privacy and security directly, but still something worth mentioning. But the FCC officially votes to reinstate net neutrality. For those of you who know what that means, then you're probably excited about that, most likely. If not, then you're fine. It's all going to be fine. But this was removed in 2015.
No, it was passed in 2015.
Well, sorry, it passed 2015. It was removed in 2017, and now it's back.
This next story was sent to us by a reader, so thank you. It says, U.S. Know Your Customer proposal will put an end to anonymous cloud users. After being under discussion for years, late January, the U.S. Department of Commerce published a notice of proposed rulemaking, hoping to reduce threats to the United States. If adopted, the proposal will establish a new set of requirements for infrastructure as a service providers, or IaaS, often known as cloud infrastructure providers, to deny access to foreign adversaries. While supposedly aimed at external threats, only positive identification of all customers can eliminate the possibility that a quote-unquote innocent domestic user isn't actually a foreign threat actor. Or, according to the proposal, anyone or all people from a specified jurisdiction at the government's discretion. Upon notification by IaaS providers, that could include foreign persons training large artificial intelligence models with potential capabilities that could be used in malicious cyber-enabled activity. Under the proposed rule, customer identification programs or CIPs, operated by IaaS providers, must collect information from both existing and prospective customers, i.e. those at the application stage of opening an account. The bare minimum includes a customer's name, address, the means and source of payment for each customer's account, email address and telephone number, and IP address used for access or administration of the account. What qualifies as an IaaS is surprisingly broad. The term includes all virtualized products and services where the computing resources of a physical machine are shared, such as virtual private servers. But it even covers bare metal servers allocated to a single person. The definition also extends to any service where the consumer does not manage or control the underlying hardware, but contracts with a third party for access. The proposed rule, the National Emergency with Respect to Significant Malicious Cyber-Enabled Activities, will stop accepting comments from interested parties on April 30th, 2024. So, at the time this releases, you should still have 2 days to go in and leave a comment, which is linked in the article there. And then, just real quick, since this is so short, Biden signs the bill criticized as a major expansion of warrantless surveillance. This was an update to a story from last week, which is why we kind of threw it at the end. Oh, this is the one. Excuse me. Earlier, I said it was the TikTok ban. This is the one we covered last week. And then, like, literally Sunday morning before we published it, Biden signed this. This is the Section 702. God forbid we request a warrant and due process from law enforcement. Just let them do whatever they want with no oversight.
All right. And now we're going to go into the free and open source news, FOSS. And we're going to start with Flatpak patch, which is addressed major sandbox escape flaw. So for those who don't know, Flatpak is a way to essentially download and use software on Linux. It makes things much simpler for people. And essentially just download the software you want, and it's all contained in the same central location. It's really nice. I'm a big fan of Flatpaks. This was actually covered on the Linux experiment last week. So again, if you want to get news from different places, that actually was covered well before we're covering it now. To get actually into the story, a new vulnerability identified as CVE-2024-32462 has been found in Flatpak, which would allow malicious applications to execute commands outside of their secure environment. Typically, applications running in Flatpak are limited to a secure environment where they can't interact with the broader system. This setup is supposed to prevent rogue apps from harming the underlying system, but they discovered a flaw where a Flatpak application could bypass the security through a mechanism involving the XDG desktop portal interface. The Flatpak team has promptly responded with patches to the vulnerability. Users are strongly recommended to update their Flatpak installations to ensure they're protected. The article notes which versions are recommended for which branches, and that Flatpak versions older than 1.10.9, including the entire 1.8.x series, are no longer supported and will not receive this crucial update.
Next up, encrypted email service files DMA complaint claiming it vanished from Google search. So we covered this last week. This is Tuda, you know, known for the encrypted service Tuda Mail. They have filed a Digital Markets Act complaint to the EU over an alleged deranking in Google search. So just to recap for anyone joining us, last week, Tuda published a blog where they said if you used Google search, I think specifically in Germany, I'm not sure about other parts of the world, if you looked for encrypted email, secure email, even like Tuda login or Tuda Nota login, their app would show up. Basically everything about them except the actual login page on the website. So they said that they had reached out to Google multiple times. Google had not given them the time of day or responded in any way, shape, or form. And they are now suing Google under the Digital Markets Act, which Europe rolled out to kind of try and, I wouldn't say break up monopolies, but maybe kind of try to level the playing field a little more. And that also ties into everything that's been going on with Apple, with sideloading and browsers and all that stuff. So we'll keep you guys updated as that progresses. Since that was short, I'll take the next one. What's new in Fedora Workstation 40? Basically, GNOME 46, from what I can tell from this blog post. I'm sure there's plenty of other stuff under the hood, but it's mostly GNOME 46 and everything that comes with it. So, for example, there's verified badges for FlatHub apps. There's dark mode, expanded public transit routing in the Maps app, extensions and calendar redesigns, disk IO resource graphs, performance improvements. IPv4 conflict detection is now enabled by default, PyTorch integration, and more.
And then I'm going to finish this out with two more Linux stories really quickly. The first one is Ubuntu 24.04 LTS. Noble Numbat overhauls its installation and app experience. And like I said, there's a new installer, and more minimal is the new default. ZFS encryption is the default option, hardware-backed full disk encryption, plus guidance for those who dual boot with Windows and BitLocker, security improvements for PPAs, restrictions to unprivileged user namespace through AppArmor, more fingerprint reader support, and more. And we have a new Linux distro on the scene that can finally run your car's safety systems and driver assistance features. Its development was led by the automotive electronic supplier Electrobit, and it's the first open source OS that complies with the automotive industry's functional safety requirements. The goal in the industry is to move to a more standardized, efficient model where there's four main domain controllers that handle different aspects of the system, which is the infotainment, the engine, driver assistance systems, and etc. This new distro is the first one that's industry approved to handle driver assistance features like managing the radar, camera, sensors, and more, which is the kind of stuff that enables lane assist, automatic braking, and more.
I also just want to add on to that one. I'm not a car guy. I wrote the summary there, so if I got anything wrong, I apologize. Finally, we are in our Misfits section. US charges Samurai Crypto Mixer founders for laundering $100 million. Keone Rodriguez and William Lonergan Hill have been charged by the US Department of Justice for laundering more than $100 million from various criminal enterprises through Samurai. For those who don't know, Samurai is a Bitcoin wallet, and I'm sure the experts could tell you more. The things that attracted me to it is it has a built-in mixer, and it also has built-in Tor compatibility. So you can do everything over the Tor network. You can mix your Bitcoin. As detailed in a superseding indictment, criminals also use Samurai's Whirlpool crypto mixer to process over $2 billion in illicit funds between 2015 and February 2024. In addition to crypto mixing services, Samurai also offered a service called Ricochet, which allowed users to send cryptocurrency using additional and unnecessary intermediate transactions to thwart law enforcement and crypto exchange efforts to track funds sourced from criminal activity. Icelandic law enforcement has seized Samurai's domains and web servers, and the Google Play Store removed the Android mobile app after being served a seizure warrant. They are both charged with two counts of conspiracy, money laundering, which is a 20-year maximum sentence, and operating an unlicensed money transmitting business, 5-year maximum sentence. This comes from the DOJ. While offering Samurai as a quote-unquote privacy service, the defendants knew that it was a haven for criminals to engage in large-scale money laundering and sanctions evasion, unquote.
The next story is pretty interesting. So a school athletic director arrested for framing the principal using AI voice synthesis. So the Baltimore County Police arrested a high school former's athletic director and charged him with using AI to impersonate the principal. Pretty much, they did an AI version of his voice, which made him say a lot of racist things to various demographics, and the recording also mentioned names of staff members, including the nickname, and suggesting that they should not have been hired or should be removed one way or another. A teacher reportedly played a large role in disseminating the audio. While she has not been charged, police indicated that she forwarded the controversial email to a student known for their ability to quickly spread information through social media. The student then escalated the audio's reach, which included sharing it with the media and the NAACP. Again, referencing some racist things that were said. The Baltimore Banner notes that Billy Burke, who's the head of the union representing the principal, was the only official to publicly suggest the audio was AI-generated. He expressed disappointment in the public's assumption of guilt and revealed that the principal and his family had been harassed and threatened, requiring police presence at their home. All right, and with that said, that's going to be the final story of the week. And so, again, we had those major updates from Proton. Dating app privacy is now getting worse. We have some of those deep fakes in the school setting, and definitely some unsettling research on phone keyboards. Watch out for that and the third-party apps that you're using. Again, if you like this podcast and you get any kind of value from it, we really appreciate the support, because that's how we keep this going every single week. So patreon.com/surveillancepod is where you can support this podcast consistently and give back to it and allow us to continue improving production and just keeping things going. If you don't like Patreon for whatever reason, we're also in LiberPay, and we also support Monero as well. Thank you all for your contributions. Thank you all for being involved. And thank you all for taking your privacy and security a little bit more seriously. And if you enjoy this and you think someone else can get value from it, definitely share it with them as well. That's another great way to help support our podcast and get the word out there. Thank you all, and see you next time.